Good evening to everybody, and welcome to the Ernest Gellner Lecture. As you know, this is part of a series of lectures that we have every year to commemorate the life and work of Professor Ernest Gellner. My name is Montserrat Gibbonneau. I'm one of the editors of Nations and Nationalism, and it's a great pleasure for me to introduce our speaker, Professor Dominique Schnapper, Director of Studies at L'École des Études Supérieures en Sciences Sociales à l'Université de Paris. She is also the head of the Constitutional Commission, and she has just been appointed to this very important role by the French government. She's been a member of various official commissions in France, and she has also been president of the French Sociological Association between 1995 and 1999. Professor Schnapper is one of the leading sociologists of this particular time, and we are very pleased to welcome her to give this Ernest Gellner lecture. Professor Schnapper is also the author of over 15 books and numerous articles on different issues to do with sociology, emigration, racism, and a very long number of specific issues. Just to mention her latest books, I will refer to Understanding Racism, What Citizenship? This is a book that's going to be translated in English, and also The Sociological Comprehension or Understanding. These are different books published by Gallimard originally and by PUF, La Compréhension Sociologique. And we hope to have soon more of Professor Schnapper's work translated into English and be able to access her work fully. Professor Schnapper is going to talk about citizenship and national identity in Europe.
First of all, I'd like to say how honored and pleased I am to have been invited to give this Gellner lecture. First of all, because like many of you, Gellner was a friend whom I admired very much. Also, it seems to me that despite Eurostar and internet, relations between French and British social scientists have become too distant when their relations are not organized through American universities. I maintain, like all those who experienced the Second World War to a certain extent, a special relationship with Britain. However, this is not the only reason why I would like to see the development of direct intellectual exchange between French and British academics. The comparison between the English notion of liberal citizenship, inspired by Locke, and the French notion of republican citizenship, inspired by Rousseau, has been for a long time a recurrent theme of political philosophy. Today, I have the feeling that the opposition between the two types of citizenship, the French and the English type, has not exhausted all its heuristic value. But at the same time, there are differences in vocabulary between the two languages, and these differences are really sources of misunderstanding. Anglophone literature refers to liberalism to designate modern democracies. Francophone literature discusses the notion of citizenship. And the differences of terminology are significant, but they are making the dialogue sometimes difficult. Social scientists take as their first object of their work historical experiences which they have witnessed and often also been the victims of. Despite the title of his famous work, Nation and Nationalism, Ernest Gellner put forward a theory of nationalism, basing his analysis above all on the history of the people of Central Europe, on the experience of German and Italian unification, and on that of European Jews and the creation of the State of Israel. My own historical experience and my intellectual training, which is described by my friends as well as my critics as being very French, are very different from his experiences. Because everybody has to contribute to the intellectual debate by adding what she can or what she is, I would like to put forward some analyses which do not concern nationalism, but rather the nation. All these terms, as you know, belong at the same time to political and scholarly vocabulary. The political vocabulary is always ambiguous, the ambiguity of the terms favoring democratic compromise. Scholarly vocabulary should not be ambiguous. Therefore, I would like to point out that my analysis concerns the democratic nation-state, the idea and first forms of which were born in England and later in America and in France. The nation in this sense, or the nation-state, was during the age of nationalism celebrated as being the perfect form of political organization. Today, on the contrary, it is the object of radical criticism, and it is often accused of being the cause of all the tragedies of the 20th century. Neither celebration nor radical criticism favor knowledge. I will therefore try to avoid both and concentrate on the historical link between the nation and liberalism, as I'm talking in English, before analyzing the possibilities of building a democratic society which is not based on the nation state. Theorists of nationalism, a large majority of whom are historians and anthropologists, have tended to ignore the meaning of modern politics. As we are aware, this was one of the major criticisms which was formulated with regard to the theory outlined by Gellner. It was another school of thought, often dominated by political philosophers, which turned its attention towards the originality of political modernity. I will try to integrate both of the theoretical domains in order to highlight the historical link which has existed until today between the nation and liberalism, or if I was speaking in French, between the nation and the society organized by citizenship. Liberalism was born in those national societies where the notion of a common language, culture, identity, and territory had a long history, namely Britain first, the United States, and France. Consequently, as far as the nationalist movements of the 19th and 20th century were concerned, the claim for political independence or nationalism was inseparable from the notion of aspiring to democracy. Until the First World War, the nation appeared to be a means of truly respecting man's humanity, in other words, his autonomy, which is symbolized through the values of equality and liberty. Nationalist claims were primarily linked to democratizations, to claims for the equality and liberty of all citizens, and even to the notion of the community of free and equal citizens as a sort of source of political legitimacy. According to the famous opening of nation and nationalism, nationalism is primarily a political principle which holds that the political and the national unit should be congruent. This political principle is not simply the result of the demands of technology in a society whose main aim is infinite economic progress, nor is it only born out of the uneven diffusion of the industrialization process. Modern society is not only industrial, it is democratic as well. Cultural homogeneity, which is and was and at least was one of the goals of the nation state, is not only necessary in order to favor the development of industrial society, it is also a condition of democracy. High culture, or the common language, is also the instrument with which we deal with and resolve tensions and conflicts in a democratic fashion, i.e., according to the laws, through negotiation and compromise, as opposed to violence. Nationalism is above all political. It is linked to the new principle of legitimacy, which became an established principle in the 18th century following the English, American, and French revolutions. The fact that the notion of a community of citizens became at that time the basis of political legitimacy and the source of a social link meant that liberal societies could not accept the idea of being governed by foreigners, those that they considered as foreigners. As modern society no longer recognized as legitimate any authority outside itself, as it built itself on a completely autonomous basis, it could no longer accept as legitimate the power of the other. This was demonstrated in the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, by the end of the colonial empires founded by the European nations. Colonialism is at odds with the principles of democratic nations. Colonial society was based on the inequality of the legal and political statuses of its members, the colonial settlers on one side, and the indigenous people on the other side. The colonials instructed a limited number of the autochthonous people who were able to master modern technology and therefore were in position to call the superiority of the West. However, above all, the colonials trained a minority of westernized indigenous peoples who then, on behalf of those whose country has been colonized, demanded the same civic rights as the colonizers. Finally, those who were colonized demanded political rights in the name of liberty and equality of all human beings and citizens. This link between the nation state and democracy is historical. It is neither logical nor necessary. Citizenship can be enjoyed on an infra or supranational basis. However, one should take into account this historical link when thinking about the nation and citizenship in theoretical terms, because the principle of citizenship can only become truly meaningful and organize historical societies if it is part of the political institution and social practices of a society, the legitimacy of both of which has been interiorized, that's difficult to say, over the centuries. A society which is based on values and on institution of citizenship is fragile. It only functions in an acceptable manner when a public sphere is constituted which transcends everyday society, its historical and religious diversities, its divisions, and its inequalities. The ties which link people are primarily legal and political. They are based upon an abstract principle, equal right and sovereignty for all citizens. It is also fragile because it is based on a utopia of a reversal of the social world, even though it is an utopia with some practical consequences. This utopia establishes, in spite of all actual social experiences, civil, legal, and political equality for individuals who are diverse and unequal in terms of their origins their abilities, and their social milieu. It is inevitable that this utopian vision gives rise to some perfectly justified criticism when everyday social reality is compared to the values the citizens refer to. This is why political institutions are so important, which have until the present time always been national, and thanks to which the abstract principle of legitimacy actually allows individuals to live together in society. These institutions' role is to organize representation, that great invention of modern democracy. As we know, during antiquity, it was a question of direct democracy. For Aristotle, delegating one's power meant renouncing one's freedom. 18th century thinkers also excluded the notion of the republic. Modern democrats, here, of course, it is necessary to stress the role of Britain in this domain. We are not far from Westminster here. Modern democrats invented the idea of representation and political institution through which to organize representation, elections, parliament, accountability of the rulers before the citizens or their representatives, participation of different social groups, and in particular political parties in the organization of free competition for power. All these institutions are expected to organize the representation of the people and guarantee the magical dimension of the election process. These institutions of representation, which are really rather strange, although we have grown so accustomed to them that they seem natural and obvious, would undoubtedly not exist if it were not for a pre-existing national society. This was the case in Britain, in the United States, and France. However, even in these cases, national societies were not thoroughly national. They were always composed of different historical collectivities, some of which are infranational and some of which are supranational. As Gellner pointed out to us, 8,000 languages are spoken throughout the world, and there are only 200 nation states which are recognized under international law, although this number is increasing. The general rule, is that historical collectivities and nation states are not congruent. Even Japan is not a perfect nation state. However, the members of those societies in which the notion of citizenship have developed had already coexisted for long enough to accept that the historical and social divergences which separated them from each other should be dealt with by common citizenship. Only the notion of citizenship that is not linked with any religion or any particular historical origin can allow people who have diverse beliefs, practices, historical and religious allegiances to live together. Even the principle of nationalism, that is the legitimate confusion of the national and the political, to use Gellner's vocabulary, has never simply remained a principle or a political ideal, even if it inspired the nationalists and diplomats who redrew the frontiers after World War I. It has never been a description of reality, even in the old historical nations. The national, by definition, is not a fixed phenomenon. It is reinvented and renewed by every generation. Human society never ceases to reproduce differences and otherness. Liberal societies have always been open societies, even before globalization multiplied the exchange of populations, capital, information, or technology. Although the nation state has always aimed to homogenize populations and create national identities and inspire mobilization in terms of the nation, its attempt to nationalize society has always been limited. In the French Jacobine nation state, regional differences only really gave way in the 1960s, and one wonders whether television and globalization have in fact been more efficient than the secular measures of the Jacobine state. And even the French know that the United Kingdom was always made up of several nations. This is why the tensions or dialectics between the national dimensions and the political order of the nation state has always been analyzed with different terminology. Ernest Gellner observed the paradox of nationalist ideology, which referred to ethnic arguments, language, race, history, territory, in order to demand the construction of a civic nation state. Anthony Smith underlined that ethnic origins and identities were not eliminated by the establishment of modern nations. For my part, I have tried to show that in each nation state, there was both what I call ethnic dimensions in collective life, that is, common history, common collective myth, common language and culture, and that these dimensions combined with the principle of citizenship, which advocates political freedom and equality for all citizens despite their diverse origins and their inequalities. In a purely analytical perspective, one should go beyond the traditional opposition between the so-called ethnic nation of Central and Eastern Europe and the so-called civic nation of Western Europe. In the liberal nation state, the tensions between the national or the ethnic forms of society and the civic principle were dealt with by the separation between the public and private sphere. In the private sphere, individuals were free to remain faithful to their specific historical origins or religious belief. The public sphere was a unified and universal space where individuals acted as citizens. Between the diversity of everyday society and the need for political order imposed by the state, the democratic nation could be interpreted as a compromise which made room for diversity, inevitable phenomenon, and the necessary unity of the public sphere to be guaranteed by the state. The nation state is also a historical and political actor which asserts its own values and desire for power vis-a-vis other states. Within the nation itself, its action is guided by the original political project and outside its own boundaries. Its action is guided by the political desire to impose itself as a historical entity. In the past, the nation has mobilized people in its political aims. It is true that mobilizing people in the name of the nation has often become nationalist in the sense of wanting to impose one's will on others or imperialists. However, mobilization in the name of the nation is not necessarily nationalist or imperialist. Nationalism as a concept has been accused of being responsible for the wars of the 20th century. Once political order is organized on the level of the nation state, wars and the constraints of society become national. It does not mean that the national itself is responsible for the outbreak of conflicts. When political order was based on dynastic, religious, or imperial principles, wars were dynastic, religious, or imperial. This does not mean that one would claim that all national forms of organization, whether democratic, authoritarian, or totalitarian, are one and the same, thus condemning them all without taking their specific political system into account. Moreover, those same passions whipped up by nations were also aroused in the struggles for liberalism or democracy. In the wars that the democracies fought in the 20th century, it was first and foremost in the name of French, or rather British, patriotism that people fought against Germany, rather than the idea of fighting against Nazism or for the defense of democratic ideals. Roosevelt could not convince the American people to go to war alongside the European democratic nations until national pride rebelled against the surprise attack of Pearl Harbor. This means that civic principle have until present been very closely linked to with national passions. Nations which have become strengthened over the centuries and which are the work of a common secular society have provided a framework of action for democracies. The nation state, which is organized and legitimized by the values and institutions of citizenship, has constituted a form of reconciliation between national particularism, or to use different term, the ethnic dimensions of society, and the universal aims of citizenship. This linking of the national and civic, national reality and civic principle is today challenged by an objective development, i.e. the growing globalization of many economic, social, and political phenomena. This tendency has weakened the significance and the effectiveness of a national society. At the same time, most theorists of nationalism and citizenship are nowadays of anti-national feeling, with the exception of some Irish and Scottish nationalists. The nation state is accused of being tyrannical and of not respecting the diversity of the peoples within its boundaries and their perfectly reasonable demand to be recognized in the public sphere. However, it is also accused of not coming up to scratch, of being too small and insignificant to take action in a world which is more and more globalized. The nation state is accused of being too weak to act in the world. It is both criticized in terms of democratic legitimacy in the inside and of political effectiveness versus the outside. I will not address the first critique, which is developed by the communitarian philosophers such as Charles Taylor and Will Kimlicker. I will discuss now what remains of the meaning and effectiveness of the nation state by reference to the problems facing the two oldest historical nation states of Europe, Britain and France. There is no doubt that they have been weakened by globalization. From this point of view, Europe seems to provide a solution for those countries where the idea of the nation was born and which are now faced with a challenge of globalization. The European nations are too small and too weak to assert themselves alone in world affairs. Together and united, they can retrieve some of their power. However, at the same time, and in a manner which sociologists would call perverse, the construction of Europe contributes to the limitation of the power of the nation state and tends to dilute national political identity. European institutions are the objective allies of regional governments who want to establish themselves in opposition to the nation state. Direct relations between the new institution of Europe and specific regions are multiplying in all member states. Regions are forging new ties with neighboring provinces and distant towns. regardless of national borders. It's more true of the continent, but might be true even here. These relations are often closer than relations with the capital of the national state. The control of migration takes place within the Schengen area and no longer at national frontiers. The construction of Europe and the increasing economic integration restrict the national government's autonomy as far as economic policy is concerned, as the French socialist government experienced in 1983. It is no longer possible to implement Keynesian economics in one country alone. In all countries, increased economic interdependence limits the sovereignty of the nation state in economic and therefore social policy. In legal terms as well, national sovereignty has been eroded. The European Court of Justice hears complaints from individuals against their national states, and on several occasions it has ruled in favor of the citizen against his, her nation state in the name of the defense of human rights. What becomes then of the historical nation states? Weakened in the domain of power struggles between states, they nevertheless continue to deal with inequalities, rivalries, and conflicts between different social groups through fiscal policy and through the welfare state. They continue to define who should be covered by social benefit and those who would enjoy a full range of political rights through the legislation which governs nationality, a domain which is solely controlled by nation states. The nation state is now essentially a social state. It has become the counterpoint for the redistribution, the center point for the redistribution of resources in the name of social justice, which allows to a certain extent to control and channel the effect of capitalism on social relations. However, it is true that there is a continuous tension between the production of wealth, which takes place on a global level, and the redistribution of that wealth, which takes place at a national level. The only comparison of Tony Blair's Third Way and French socialism by Jospin and Aubry shows that as far as terminology and practice are concerned, national variations in the ideas and the policies of the left still exist from one country to another. Political weakening has not, however, led to the end of the identification value of the nation, which still is an instrument of socialization and the domain of collective historical experience. All nations still express themselves in terms of a certain number of values and still pride themselves as being the source of certain inventions and projects. Even if the modern individual claims to be fundamentally autonomous, he still needs to identify with a collective. In the old historical nation states, this collective identity is still often the nation, even though this reference to the nation does not exclude, of course, references to other identities, whether infra or transnational. However, what is undoubtedly more important is that the nation remains the central point for democracy and political will. It is both reasonable and desirable to construct Europe in order to face the challenges of globalization and the diminishing capacity of historical nation states to act. But how long will it take for Europe to develop the political legitimacy and political will of historical nations? It took centuries, plural, to build nations. How long will it take to build a political Europe? Even if all Europeans refer to the notion of citizenship, the practices and institutions through which this principle organizes a political system is extremely different from one country to another, depending on the history, the formation of the state, as well as the political circumstances under which the notion of citizenship was developed. The Glorious Revolution of 1688 is not the French Revolution of 1789. The liberal British citizen is not the French Republican citizen. The practical consequences and character of a particular conception of citizenship has always been, and for the time, remains national. Each European population is normally attached to its own political institution. Each European Union member state has its specificity. And yet, citizenship would become a purely formal principle if it was not translated into practical consequences by the political institutions which organize the common life. It is not a question, therefore, of erasing or eradicating national specificity, but to analyze the challenge that they present for the organization and legitimization of a European public sphere. The development of a true European citizenship would mean the construction of a European public space within which the members of the various European countries would recognize each other as citizens. The issues at stake, the debates, and the institution would have to form a common political sphere for all. To be precise, it would mean that French or British voters would vote for Italian, German, or Spanish politicians, not in terms of their national identity, but because of their political identification, because they share the same view of the world, the same social aspirations, and the same values. This means that European citizens would have to consider that European deputies, or MEPs, who are elected as a result of European elections, are as legitimate as the MPs of Westminster, that they would accept the decisions they take, even if they are contrary to their immediate interests. This is the most important issue at stake if citizenship is to take a real character and not remain purely formal. In other words, it is a question of breaking the historical link between citizenship and the nation. This is what the enthusiastic theorists of the new citizenship advocate. They all criticize the so-called classic national or political citizenship in terms of its values and effect. At the same time, they consider this devaluation of classical citizenship as positive. They hope that it will be replaced by a new conception of citizenship, which is more economic and social in character, and which will be the basis of a renewed democratic practice of a participative democracy. The citizenship should no longer be defined as a collection of political rights and freedom, but by social rights, or to be more accurate, social rights have become the truly political rights. This is why, for certain pro-European campaigners, residence alone should be required for the acquisition of citizenship, excluding all other demands in terms of will or will with national norms or laws. There is another way of discussing this matter that you must know. It's Jürgen Habermas, who also tries to outline a theory which would separate the nation and citizenship in order to develop what he calls a post-national form of citizenship, and he introduced the concept of constitutional patriotism, where the citizenship would be applied only on the European level, while we would keep our national feelings at the level of the nation. Therefore, patriotic feeling would no longer be linked to the nation state, to a special historical society, but be linked to the universalistic principle of citizenship. I wonder how far these ideas are realistic. Can we in the foreseeable future separate national identity and purely political allegiance separate the nation and citizenship, which have been so closely linked through the history of liberalism. Democratic society implies that there are certain spheres in the abstract and real sense of the world, where citizens, politicians, and experts can meet and discuss, try to understand one another, and attempt to convince each other over certain issues without using violence, try to arbitrate conflicts between individuals and groups to come to compromises. Human society is normally divided by passions, tensions, and conflicts. What is a characteristic of a democratic society is the fact that these divergences are recognized, legitimized, and managed according to the laws of a legally constituted state. This implies that all members of the state concerned should share the same language, and if not, at least the same vocabulary or terminology, a common culture, at least a common political culture, and values. If it's not the case, how is it possible to organize these spheres of dialogue and negotiation which define democratic practice? Human society, even democratic, modern, or even postmodern societies, cannot evacuate the purely political dimension. If they did, there would no longer be any legitimate body to control inevitable human, ethnic, and racial passions, to arbitrate between the interests of individuals and groups who are by definition divergent or opposed to one another, to rally people together against an outside danger. At whatever level it takes shape, it is necessary to have a political domain, the space for making choices, for arbitration, a sphere which is defined by its constraints and at the same time its desire to exist. It is necessary to maintain a sphere where individuals can observe that the people they have elected are representing their interests in an acceptable manner. It is necessary for a society to dispose of various institutions whose decisions and the constraints which necessarily accompany go with these decisions are considered to be legitimate and therefore accepted by the citizens. Human society is not made up of legal subject or citizen. Citizen is a utopian idea, although it is an utopia with practical consequences. It is made up of real individuals who have their passions and specific identities. A purely civic society is hardly likely to mobilize people. The principles and institutions of citizenship cannot frame, control, and organize a society unless they take into account the reality of human society and the passions of those members of a particular society. The abstract and tangible aspects of the nation are more inspiring, mobilizing than purely abstract notions such as class consciousness, a legally constituted state, and human rights, as Benedict Anderson puts it, who is ready to die for Comecon or the European community. It was before, it was in the time that Comecon did exist. One might fear that a purely civic society would weaken democratic nations who are today less and less political. Anxiety with regards to this phenomenon is all the more widespread since the economic and social dimension of society are increasingly dominating social relations. It is not a question of denouncing the power of the market, nor refusing to see its effectiveness, nor condemning economic progress. That would be preposterous. However, one must accept the possibility that modern society may disintegrate because of the wiping out of the civic and the decline of the political dimensions in society which are organized around the notion of production. The construction of Europe runs the risk of producing an unwanted effect, the weakening of political will at the level of the nation may take place before it can express itself elsewhere, that is, through the political institution of Europe. The European Union, which is a great political project, runs the risk of contributing involuntarily to the weakening of the political consciousness and will of the European nations. Defense is not necessarily national, no more than citizenship, but the desire to defend oneself and to affirm collective values must exist somewhere, either at the level of the nation or on the European level. There is a risk that solidarity within our societies will only become weaker and that Europe will establish itself in the world to a lesser extent than the historical nation states. And yet, we wouldn't be the first to go down this path. History has shown that those political entities which has not affirmed their own values and of themselves for self-defense have met tragic ends. The construction of a political Europe is a great political project, and as a citizen, I support it strongly. The nations of Europe share common principles and values. They are clearly very close to one another, and each nation is too small to take action. It is desirable that they eliminate the possibility of even going to war with each other through the creation of a new form of political entity. However, one should not underestimate the problem involved in this project, which some of the theorists of new citizenship have a tendency to do. The project will not succeed if the historical and political traditions of nations are denied, traditions within which the institutions of democracy were developed. Rather, these traditions should be developed, overcome, transcended. Democratic society based their legitimacy on the debates between citizens. A politically unified Europe will only succeed if it is a Europe of citizens. Rather than the separation of the national and the civic, or the end of political citizenship, I suggest that it would be necessary to rethink a new relationship between the national and the civic and the European. A European sphere, public sphere, could be organized around a political form inspired by federalism. This would not simply be the extension of national public space, but a new form of political organization which would take the existence of historic nation states fully into account, which is what the founding fathers of the American Constitution did. The United States were based on both the notion of a community of citizens and a federation of states. There exists no model for this project, but after having invented the principle of the nation, perhaps the Europeans will invent a political entity which surpasses the nation as well. We must have confidence in their capacity to do so. I will give a last and concluding remark. A political space is necessary for the expression and exercise of liberal democracy. Until now, this political space was the nation. Ernst Gellner indirectly recognized that the nation had a positive role when he reminded readers of the dangers of a world government in thought and change, and I'd like to finish by quoting his sentence. The main boon which nationalism has conferred on mankind, the main advantage flowing from the system of locks into which the world is now politically divided, might be political. If a politically united world were passing through the second global phase of industrialization, this united world might well come to resemble the present condition of South Africa. Pluralism is some kind of insurance against both tyranny and political folly. I think he was deeply right. A politically unified world would be without collective identity and political will. And the manifestation of ethnic tensions could no longer be controlled by democratic institutions. In the historic nation state, the civic principle represented, or citizenship, represented an instrument through which conflicts between different historical groups within the same political entity could be managed or dealt with. National solidarity justified the redistribution of resources and made it possible to deal with social inequality in accordance with the conception of social justice. Of course, Europe can manage this as well, but it will take strong political will and a lot of time for citizens to regard the political institution of Europe as being as legitimate as their own national institution. Of course, Europe should be built, but nations as political entities should not be destroyed before truly European citizenship is constructed. The 20th century has taught us that without the control of civic reason and democratic political institution, the mankind's passions and violence is always ready to unleash itself. Thank you. I have been told that this room had to be empty at 6:30. So I'm quite willing to answer questions, but we have 5 minutes.
That's okay. Thank you.
Yes. No, I think we have to invent it. I don't think we have a good model. I mean, look at all the countries, except for America. After all, America is quite a success. But except for America, the other experiences are not very convincing, I agree with you. But, I mean, once more, we have no experienced history that sovereign nations decide, with no wars, decide to give part of the sovereignty to another institution. So we really have to invent it. In the last 2 or 3 years, I'm less optimistic about the possibility of constructing Europe. I don't think it's on a very good way. But I think it's a great project and that we should all work for it. But I see it as very difficult and I'm not that optimistic. And on federalism, except for the United States, I don't think we have very good examples. I agree with you. No, you're right about Switzerland, although it began, Switzerland was a kind of genius for 150 years because it organized to live together a German-speaking majority with the two Italian French-speaking majority. But now they are beginning to speak English between them, so it's really the end of the genius of the political imagination of Switzerland. It has worked well, and it works well in Canada too. We have other examples of federalist states working well. I mean, Canada works well. They have a really complicated problem with the French-speaking Canadians, and there are no terrorism in Canada to deal with a very difficult problem. No, there are the federal, but I mean, both in Canada and Switzerland, there are really very different conditions compared to the European cases.
There is time for a final question.
It could take time, but I mean the different. There can't be a model just like that for European countries.
You beautifully pointed out how long it takes to achieve a sense of common identity, and in the case of France, even after the revolution, it isn't until the end of the Second Empire that people are beginning, all of them, to speak French, most of them, to speak French.
They really knew all to speak French in the 1960s.
given that difficulty and how long it takes, how can it be possible to achieve this sense of common identity among people speaking so many languages and coming from so many ways of thinking and culture, even in Western Europe?
Well, it's for the point of my paper that it was difficult and that we shouldn't overlook the difficulties and that we should work on it. The question of the language is central. I don't think we can have democratic practices if we don't speak the same language. And the answer is obvious. Political institutions will work in English in the European institutions. The funny thing is that the English are not the most enthusiastic for going to these institutions, but obviously the common language. I had a long discussion with Habermas, who said very calmly, well, there's no problem, we'll talk in English in all European institutions. And of course it's not a problem for the United Kingdom, it's not really a problem for the Nordic countries, it's not really a problem for the new Germany. It's less a problem for Italy and Spain. It's a great problem for the French because they don't like speaking another language than their own. And they usually speak very badly any other language than their own. So more generally, I think it is a problem because, as I try to say, democracy is to talk instead of using violence. And to talk, it's better to understand a little of what the other says. Let's be simple.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Dominik Schnapper, for this challenging, stimulating, and thought-provoking lecture. And we all look forward to read it published in Nations and Nationalism. As we have seen, Ernest Gellner's work remains a source of inspiration for scholars across different disciplines. And I wouldn't like to close this annual Ernest Gellner lecture without saying that it's been a great pleasure for us to have Mrs. Susan Gellner here with us tonight. Tomorrow, as you all know, we've got the annual ASEAN conference on territory and nation. You are all welcome to attend. And thank you very much again, Professor Schnapper, and thank you very much to all of you for attending.